Okay, so we're very happy to bring together two art history scholars this morning who have both taught in China, lectured in China, and who are very interested in Chinese art and culture. So I'm going to introduce them now. Dr. Christopher Crouch, who will be speaking second, is from currently teaching in Australia. He's the director for the Center for Studies in Chinese Arts and Visual Culture at the School of Communication and Arts at Edith Cowan University in Perth, Australia. He's taught in China on and off for the last decade and in various places, universities there. He has several books, two of which have been translated into Chinese. One is called The History of Design, and the other is called Modernism in Art, Design, and Architecture. And that book is actually the standard textbook for the art historical period of modernism in both Australia and the United Kingdom. He's also written a book called Subjectivity, Creativity, and the Institution. So he's interested in, you know, the subjective side of education. He was very eager to come here and learn about consciousness-based education that we do here at MUM. So he's currently teaching a course, getting firsthand experience of that right now in modernism. His most recent book is called Research in Design. And he's edited a book called Contemporary Chinese Visual Culture. Most of these books are in our library, if you'd like to take a look at them. Okay, so the way we're going to do this morning is both speakers will speak for some time, and then after both have spoken, we'll have them both together here at the front. You can ask questions, and they'll engage in a discussion about Chinese art and culture. We're also very happy to welcome Lenore Metric Chen from Drake University, where she's an associate professor teaching art and cultural history. You know, as you know, Drake is in Des Moines, Iowa. She specializes in imagology, which means examining visual art as a language of cultural communication. Very fascinating area. And this is exemplified in her writings, such as Andy Goldsworthy's Art as a Visual Measure, which is in the book Impermanence, Cultures in, Out of Time, and in exhibitions such as Imaging Others in the Colonial Period. Much of her research focuses on the transnational relations of visual culture and people between the United States and China, discussed in her forthcoming book, which is entitled Collecting Objects, Excluding People, Chinese Subjects and the American Visual Culture, 1830 to 1900. She is currently exploring contemporary Chinese-American art and ideas of race, and is delighted to have a National Endowment for the Humanities Summer Grant to explore this. So please welcome Lenore Metric Chen.
Thank you all for inviting me, and I really appreciate it. I'm not sure how to do the slides.
You're going to have to give me a signal.
Oh, okay.
A finger or a point?
Okay. There are some didactic information under some of the slides, but what I did was I cut my lecture down. First, I worked subtractively, so I put everything in that I thought I would want to say. That was about 86 slides. And then I cut it down, and I think I got it down to 70, and then I gave up, and I thought, I'll just fit it into the half hour and see which lecture of all the possibilities the slides lead to is the one that happens. The one that I most want to do is called Bumping into the Limits of Cultural Translation. And this comes directly out of my experience in China last year, last summer. I spent a month at a Confucius Center, and we studied very intensively with three professors. Two were from Hawaii, and one was from Beijing. And I had a very interesting experience there. And so what I want to do, the structure of this lecture, since I had a few lectures in mind, is a lecture within a lecture. And is everything okay?
Where's the light?
Can we turn the lights?
Yes.
Yeah, when you start showing the slides, yeah. I'll turn off
yeah.
The lights.
So the lecture within the lecture is I want to frame what happened in China for that month, which was a real insight for me into a cultural translation I hadn't expected. Could I have the next slide? So these slides are not going to be mainly ones you have to read, but this sort of sets up the history of Confucianism in China in one slide. So it's pretty condensed. But okay, Confucius is in China. He's born there. He teaches there. Several centuries later, skipping ahead, Buddhism comes into China. There's always Taoism. Confucianism gets very integrated with Buddhism and Taoism. These isms are really Western ways of thinking about ethics and culture in China. Chinese people don't necessarily say, I'm a Buddhist, even if they practice what we would consider Buddhism. They don't think that you're a Buddhist unless you're almost a monk. And so they don't separate things out in the same way. Similarly, people will practice Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism and not have a problem with it, unlike what we think of as isms. If you're a Christian, you don't practice Judaism, or you're not a Muslim. So we have this way of separating things. And as you'll see in the course of the lecture, the Chinese have a much more integrated way. And that's part of the Confucianist thought. It's a way of seeing relationships that cohere rather than boundaries between things. So then we're jumping to the 20th century, and the West starts to study concepts of Confucian teachings, and that's when it becomes an ism, when it comes to the West. So you have 20th century Western concepts of Confucianism. So Confucianism, which has been translated in China to different ideas, now comes to the West and is retranslated. Confucianism and Chinese thought start to influence mid-century Western art. Then mid-century Western art goes to China at the end of the century and influences Chinese art. At the same time, you have the Chinese start to criticize Confucius in the 70s, and there's a whole campaign to eradicate Confucius thought as being very backwards. So the Chinese themselves try to eradicate this huge cultural influence and say, what would China be like without Confucianism? Now there's a reclaiming of Confucius by the party officials. He's being sanctioned again, and we're not going to get into the politics in this lecture, but afterwards, in the question answer, if you would like to talk about it, we can. There's a popularity of contemporary Chinese art in the West. In fact, one of the most lucrative art markets is the Chinese contemporary art market in the West. Not so much in China. In China, there's a real difficulty for the Chinese artist to be seen in China, to be noticed in China, or even to be accepted. That was the cultural translation. We're finally at the cultural translation that's the subject of this lecture. So I just wanted to give you a brief chronology of where things came from. So now we've arrived at the point where, next slide, please. There's one of our teachers, and in our classroom, we're studying about Confucianism, and they're giving us all sorts of information. It went on all day, 4 hours before lunch, and then about 3 hours after lunch, and then after dinner, again, we'd have some Confucius activity. Next slide. And there's all three of the professors. So the professor I'm talking about is Professor Tian, who was very interested in going to the West when he was younger. He studied in the West. And then he returned to China and embraced the Chinese ideas, especially the official party ideas. When I showed my... he had asked me to talk about Confucianism in art. And he had said, after I did the first part of my lecture, which was on Confucianism in traditional Chinese dynastic art, he was really excited, and he invited me to come and be a teacher there the following year, you know, and I thought that was great. Then I did the second part of my lecture the next day, and it was on Confucianism in contemporary Chinese art, and I got disinvited. And so that was startling to me. In fact, he spoke first after the lecture ended, and he was furious, and he said, "That isn't Chinese art. Those people aren't Chinese. They're confused. They have nothing to do with China." So he completely disavowed these Chinese artists, and it was shocking for me and for the students. And I won't get into the consequences right now, but the students were shocked into silence. But after the professor left, about 7 of the Chinese students came and wanted to know more, and I've been doing a kind of tutorial over email with them because they have been so interested in learning, and they can't find a place to learn about it in most of China. Next slide, please. So this is the sort of thing, and I'm not going to read it out. You can read it to yourselves. This is the sort of thing that we would be discussing. But let me give you a little information about Confucius. When we think about philosophy in the West, we often think about Greek philosophy, and a lot of it is ideal, like idealized philosophy. Plato spoke about a more ideal situation. It's, in a way, it's abstract. It's trying to generalize from the specific. Confucian ideas are not that way. So it becomes a real controversy in the West. Is it a philosophy? Is it a religion? What is this thing? Because we want to fit it into a Western category, but it isn't a Western category. It doesn't fit. Confucius was deeply interested in the problems of his day. And so the book that we call the Analects is replete with references to people in his time, to issues of his time, to places and events. And his thought is grounded in what's happening at that time. The ultimate elaboration of the Confucian idea is how we as human beings impact and are affected by the cosmos. In other words, there's not a separation between human nature and cosmos. Everything affects each other. That's what I'm talking about. You don't have strict boundaries between things. But in Confucianism, it is what he's talking about, a sense, can I have the next slide, please? That everything is in the process of contextualizing her or himself. And they called that in our class a focus field. So that you are the center of whatever field you're in, but so is everything else. It's they are the centers. And so you are in a field, and you're also a focus. It's sort of like saying we're both local and global at the same time. So it has that feeling to it. This, I thought, was a really interesting statement that kind of, in one paragraph, says what Confucianism is. So I'm going to just read it out. Once they saw how things fit together most productively, their wisdom reached its heights. Once their wisdom reached its heights, their thoughts were sincere. Once their thoughts were sincere, their hearts and mind knew what is proper. Once their hearts and mind knew what is proper, their persons were cultivated. Once their persons were cultivated, their families were set right. Once their families were set right, their state was properly ordered. And once their state was properly ordered, there was peace in the world. From the emperor down to the common folk, everything is rooted in personal cultivation. There can be no healthy canopy when the roots are set, and it would never do for priorities to be reversed between what should be invested with importance and what should be treated more lightly. This is called both the root and the height of wisdom. In other words, just to summarize briefly, you start with the root, yourself. You have to cultivate yourself, and by doing so, every relationship is therefore, if everyone is doing that, all the relationships become cultivated and ultimately leads to peace. Next slide. This slide is mainly just saying that there was a lot of discussion in the class about looking at the West, and there was a lot, even though Confucianism is supposed to be about embracing and seeing how things work dialectically, nevertheless, in our class, the West was kind of demonized in a certain way, and it was reduced to being a transcendental Christian. Next slide, please. So that was put in contrast to Confucianism. No transcendental, no absolute principles, no competition, no dualisms, but continuity and correlation. And that was the key word. Everything was about correlation. Next slide, please. So here's the focus field. The Chinese structure of Ren, or human, is the little centered dot, but everything is in a field, and they're all in a relationship. And then this was the Western picture, which was never really explained, but it has something to do with standing alone, symbolized by a triangle. I'm not quite sure. So, next slide. And this was a friend of mine there. Late one night, he was explaining the whole Confucius theory and the I Ching to me, and use this diagram. So I just thought I would show you that things get diagrammed out, and a lot of circles and a lot of correlations. You can start anywhere. So the triangle was really one that had rigid boundaries, and they used the circle to show a lot of movement in between and around. Next slide. So now we're at the lecture I gave at the Confucius Center. And I am really going to rush through this because the lecture was much longer. And so I've already condensed two lectures into one, and I'm going to condense this even further. Again, if you're interested in a slide that I don't talk about, please just let me know later. Next slide. So I started off comparing traditional Chinese art, dynastic Chinese art, to traditional Western art like Renaissance and after. So this is a typical landscape painting that we think of, almost a cliche thought about Chinese art. Next slide. And this is Mark Tansey, one of my favorite contemporary artists. And here's his short history of modernist painting. I think you might be interested. You do a lot of modernism. And so this whole idea is, the first people thought, like the Renaissance, art is a window into the world. And then, probably starting in the 60s with minimalism, it became an obstacle that you butt your head against. What is this thing? And now, with postmodernism, art is like all about identity and who am I and what do I see myself as, so the viewer always sees themselves. So now you know all about Western art. Next slide, please. So, again, returning to the comparison, we have this great interest in landscape that's happening roughly in the same time, this is a few centuries later, in the West. You have a landscape in the background. You do have some sort of mountains and valley and water, but you have this gigantic portrait placed right in front of it. So just briefly to make that quick visual. And next slide. And I couldn't help but show this as well, moving up into the 19th century, again, showing the traditional Chinese. And then here you have the mountain view again. There's a human figure planted right in front. So instead of having a sense of the land, the cosmos being the most important, you have a human being kind of taking ownership. And they're, as far as their eye can see, they have a kind of priority about this whole land. Next slide. Oh, I like walking around. I'm really bad with these things. Okay, this is Brian Cousy. What I want you to get from this slide, as I said, we're not really doing art history as much as just picking and choosing. Look at the detail that is in this
painting, every single square inch is filled with something that looks strongly realistic. If you get close enough, of course it doesn't. You realize that it's paint and it's a flat surface. But the whole idea in Western art is to create this illusion and to show that each thing isn't painted. You erase the fact that it's work. You erase the fact that there are brush strokes. And you try to make it look, even to the slightest fraction, as if it is the thing itself. So there's a sense of emphasizing an illusion over over work, over process. Next slide. And again, with the Vermeer, next slide. I thought that went with the little dots. This is the Vermeer, and even when you get very, very close up, you see the realism, but if you get as close as this, you can see that it's not as real as it looks. You can see absolutely that there's a whole abstract element happening at the level of the painter's eye, but the painter does know how to make that all cohere if you're a certain distance away. Next slide. This is very different than Chinese art. Chinese art is about the movement, the motion that you are making. It's about the process. And you leave every brush stroke you make is a trace of the process that the artist went through. Not only that, but all these brush strokes, this is just a small sample, are named. If you name something, then it becomes a thing in itself. There are no names, really very few names, I should say, for what Western artists do with oil painting. There's scumbling and things like that. But mainly you can make little dots, you can make, you know, slashy lines. You use descriptive terms. Here you say, oh, I'm going to learn how to do the large X cut or the small X cut or the hemp fiber or things like this. So everything is named, and part of learning to be a good Chinese landscape painter is learning all this vocabulary, learning the linguistic structure. Next slide. So here's one of the most famous. How am I doing for time? Good. 15 minutes.
Okay. So here's one of the most famous Chinese landscapes from the Northern Song Dynasty, and it's called Early Spring. And you have this sense not only that it's showing you a mountain, but you don't know how to read it unless you start somewhere. Let's start at the top. And you start to work down. And you see that as you are looking at this mountain, you're almost like going through the process of spring, moving through the mountain. You have these areas on top. They're still remote and cold. Then you reach this misty area where something is happening. And then towards the bottom, you start to have growth and warmth. So if you went in the other direction, you'd realize that it's not just a painting of an object. It's a painting of a process. And it's about early spring. It's about that whole melting. And you see that happening across this whole mountainscape. Next slide, please. So the thing also is, if you look at the work, you realize that what makes Guoxi so virtualistic, if that's the word, is his use of all these different brush strokes. He can use all these different styles to create this harmonious landscape. Not only that, next slide. Not only that, but you can hardly see it, but if you blow it up big enough, you notice there's actually people, tiny little human beings in this mountainscape. Well, I'll talk about that in a minute. Next slide. Here's Fan Huan, Travelers in the Mountains and Streams from the same time period. And again, I put in the approximate measures, 6 feet high, about 2.5 feet wide. It's really tall. And what you look at mainly is you're confronted almost on the surface, almost right up to the picture plane, is this enormous mountain. And then way down below, it's called Travelers. Where are those travelers? Well, you look, here's all these mountains and crags and things happening here, nature. But way down below, way up inside, maybe those are the travelers. Why are people so small? If I'm telling you that people are
part of the cosmos, and things start with making harmony with people. Why are they so small? It's just, to our eyes, it might seem like Fan Quan and Chinese artists are emphasizing nature over humanity. Next slide, please. And there you can see a close-up of the travelers. One of the things you notice also is the road that they're taking somehow must continue, but something happens behind this rock that we can't see, and the river is here. It's part of that lack of boundaries in Chinese art. Now, back to the question of why are the people so small? It's because it's about process. And as you're the viewer, you're looking at this process. You're not looking at the picture as a done deal. You're inventing the picture as you look. Your eye seizes upon each of these crags and jagged lines, and as your eye travels along the jagged lines, you are creating the picture. So it's not just about the travelers in the picture. It's about you at the scene yourself. You write yourself into the artwork. Also, Chinese people read from right to left traditionally. So you would start here, where these tiny travelers are, and then you would move among the mountains and go upwards. So your eye is taking you through the entire thing. You can imagine, too, that with scrolls, rather than hanging artwork, with the long rolled scrolls, that really does put you into the process, because you would be unscrolling and scrolling, and you would be traveling along with it. Next slide. Let's move on. That's me doing a Chinese art piece. Just really fast, this is from the Qing Dynasty and the illustration of inner circulation. I just wanted to show you that even your inside is a microcosm of the land and the cosmos. So this is the inside of your circulation, your body, your mouth at the top, and so on, your organs. Next slide. And you can see a tiny human being in here and a cityscape, pagoda here. Next slide. And at a certain area of your intestines, there's an ox drawing a plow. So even inside of you, it's a microcosm of the outside. Next slide. So quickly, we're going to go through what happens in the 20th century with the West taking in the Eastern artworks. Next. We start in America in the 19th century. Typical genre painting. Somebody is doing some household work. It's very sweet and lovely, almost like Norman Rockwell has continued that tradition. And you have a narrative. You can imagine a whole story. You also have perspective. You feel like you know that she's in a little bit deeper space, and behind her the space recedes forever. Compare that to the same time period, American collectors and museums started showing works like this. How were American audiences, how was the West going to make sense of this strange, non-narrative artwork, much more emblematic, much less color? I mean, obviously it was blue, but it's more monochromatic, it's white and blue. What are we going to do with it? Next slide, please. So Whistler was one of the first artists to start to use the Chinese language and Japanese language as well, but here very influenced by Chinese language in his work. You notice the monochrome. You notice also that there's no deep space. It's much flatter. And you've taken away the narrative. She's standing there very iconically. It's not going to tell you a story. It's there in a way that starts to be called art for art's sake. It didn't tell you a story. It didn't tell you about morality. It was there to be not just a decoration, but something that we hadn't yet defined. Next slide. So you can see that in some ways she resembles the Chinese work much more than the American other 19th century piece. Next slide. And this is also by Whistler. And this is a piece where you can tell all his interests in Japanese art and Chinese art have come to the fore. And the woman is no longer separating herself from the artworks. She is an artwork. She's holding artwork. The whole thing becomes kind of seamless. And if you notice again, even though there's a sense of putting her in a space, She's also taking up this whole diagonal plane. There's a flatness to it. There's a sense that it's not going to tell you a story, but that it's there to be about the pigment on the canvas as much as about anything else. To be about something that if you turned it upside down and didn't even know it was a woman, it would still be just as satisfying. Next slide. Oh, Whistler. And then he gets really, really abstract. And what you start to see is that same interest in the flattening of the surface that Chinese artists had, he is sharing. So at the same time that you could read it as fireworks and a seascape, you can also see it as decoration, very abstract, flat paints on a canvas. Next slide. Okay, really fast. This is what's happening in the West by the mid-century of the 20th century. You all know Jack Kerouac, probably, and that he wrote a book called On the Road. He also wrote Dharma Bums. Obviously, Dharma Bums, very influenced by Eastern thought. On the Road is, in a sense, the translation at the time of Tao, Tao being road. And so he's thinking about this whole Eastern idea of traveling through your life. Next. And he also wrote it as a scroll. So, next slide. At this generation later, decade later, art becomes increasingly ephemeral. It's not about a material object. Again, a very Eastern notion has entered into Western art. Western art has been about commodities in a sense. It's been a question about it. Now we can, next slide. This is one of my favorite artworks. It's Robert Rauschenberg's Erase de Kooning drawing. And when Rauschenberg was about some of your age, you know, a brash student or just after school, he went to one of the most famous American artists, knocked on his door, and said, "Can you give me one of your drawings so I can erase it?" And it took a lot of persuasion, and finally de Kooning gave him a drawing that was with ink. It had a lot of different media on it, and de Kooning had to use all sorts of chemicals and erased it. So it's very much a very different concept of Western art than we've had previously. We can talk more about that too. Next slide. Oh, I forgot to say, this is also my favorite artist. I like a lot of art. Joseph Kossuth, 1 in 3 chairs. So he takes the definition of chair. If you have read your Plato, you know that he goes into a whole thing about chairs. He's like, what is a chair? If that's a chair and that's a chair and they don't look alike, what is the real chair? And his idea is that in another sphere, kind of a higher sphere, there's the ideal chair and all the other chairs in the, that are material are copies of this ideal chair. So Kossuth is playing with that idea. He has the definition of chair. Is that what a real chair is? He has a chair that's a material thing. And then he has the photograph, the image of that chair. So again, this whole questioning of what is reality and what is where does reality lie? Next. Now we come to China after the Cultural Revolution and after the death of Mao and the politics change. The whole gamut of Western art floods into China all at once. So artists who have not seen any contemporary Western art now don't have a chronology. They just see it all at once. Next slide. So Duchamp from the 20s comes in, and Chinese artists play with that and, again, use the Chinese export signifiers, the blue and white ware, to kind of talk about it as their own. Next slide. And here I'm just showing you very quickly some of the parallels, the Chineseization of Western techniques that they hadn't had before. Next slide. There's so much more to be said about this than what I'm saying, but you can see that using Western techniques and then kind of using them against Western companies. Next slide. Oh, but by the way, I think that that last slide, the one on Coca-Cola, was bought by some huge corporation in the United States. So it's like you think that you're making art that offends these people, but instead they just love it, you know? So
it becomes really problematic how to make counterculture art anymore because the culture will buy counterculture art. Next slide. By the 1970s, artists had become very radicalized, and this is an illustration of taking art and not separating it from the issues of the world. Art has to be part of all these issues. Next slide. Chris Burden did a piece called Shoot, and he was expecting his friend, who was supposed to be a marksman, to kind of just graze his shoulder, but the marksman missed and actually shot him. So you have this violence entering into the art world, not just the art world entering into the violent struggles. Next slide. Here's a very famous piece from 1989 in Beijing, where an huge art exhibit opened up, and as part of the artist's piece, she shot into these phone booths. Then the whole exhibit got closed down. So again, the Chinese are appropriating the cultural visual language of the West, but as they're appropriating it, they're changing it and morphing it, and it becomes things that are read differently in the Western culture than in the Chinese culture. And it still has lots of Chinese elements. Next slide. If you remember, that same year was the Goddess of Democracy was built and put in Tiananmen Square. It was highly regarded. Lots of crowds came to see it. Next slide. The students at the Central Academy of Arts were the ones who built it, and it was very enormous. It got lots of attention. Unfortunately, it got very negative attention from party officials. Next slide. And they called in the tanks, and there was a huge massacre of the students and the people who were protesting at Tiananmen Square. I showed this slide. I found out that you're not supposed to show this slide. And, in fact, the party officials have banned any discussion of this. Most of the students know that something happened, but they don't have any real facts. It's word of mouth. And if you try to get on the internet and pull up one of these pictures, I'm like, oh, they're all over the internet. They're not on the Chinese internet. So this was the point in my lecture where I thought everyone was really interested, and they were like shocked into a kind of murmur. But I thought it was me, but it was the slide. Next slide, please. So after that, this is where I'm bringing Confucianism back into Chinese art. Here's Song Dong, one of the more famous Chinese artists who moved to the United States and lived here for about 20 years. Now he's back in China. He's actually one of the heads of their art academy where he had been a student. But this whole idea of breath is really important. The qi is one of the Chinese terms that's very important. And he is showing a kind of harmony with the different weathers, with the different places, that his breath has some effect, however small, on these enormous vistas. Next slide. And I'm comparing it with Andy Goldsworthy, and who does, in a sense, visually a similar piece. So you might say, oh, the Chinese artist appropriated that, but the Chinese artist is such about a different thing. Because Goldsworthy's piece is about a shadow. When he gets up, he leaves a dry shadow on the gravel. Very different than thinking about qi and energy and your whole environment. Next slide. Zhang Huan, I'm comparing him to Vito Acconci here. And again, Vito Acconci's trademarks in the 70s, you know, the sense of what is really my own, and so he bites into his skin and shows that's how he can brand himself, literally and figuratively. So there's a sense of nudity, there's a sense of body danger or hurt in some way that's shared with the Chinese artist. But the Chinese artist, his piece was to... he coated himself with honey, next slide, please, and sat in a typical outhouse and let the flies swarm on him. And this, again, goes along with the Chinese values. If you start from the root and move outward, if there's something corrupt at a certain point, the rest of the system will be corrupt. And he's saying, look at how people, you know, this is a daily thing that people have to go to these outhouses, and they're disgusting and they're filthy, and who's going to, you know, these are public places. And so he's calling attention to it, not thought of as Confucianist by my professor. Next slide. How am I doing for time now? I don't want to.
3-4 minutes.
Oh. Okay. So the last thing I want to talk about is writing. And in the traditional calligraphy, there's types of calligraphy that are very legible, and then there's types that are really loved. They're beloved, but they're considered wild calligraphies. And they're much more freestyle, and they can be so wild as to be almost illegible. Most people cannot read them. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. So Xu Bing is a very famous Chinese artist who did this piece. He called it Book from the Sky, and he created 4,000 Chinese characters. So his book hangs as a traditional scroll, but on a much grander scale, huge scale, with all these Chinese characters, all these traditional Chinese books. Next slide. Show characters. When the West would go to see these works, they would be like, it's very awe-inspiring. You know, you just have all these words, and they must come from the heavens. What do they say? We don't know. But the whole overall impression is very impressive. You know, it's just a breathtaking art piece to see. But when the Chinese people would go to see this artwork, they had a different experience because it's almost legible, but it's not. And so the Western people don't read Chinese. They didn't know that nobody could read it and that it was gibberish. So they didn't feel like they were missing something or that the words were resisting meaning. But the Chinese people were like, they wanted it to make sense. It didn't make sense. It was very frustrating. And a lot of people, there was a huge controversy. Some people liked the piece, but a lot of people resented this piece and felt that Xu Bing was really deriding Chinese culture. Next slide. Next slide. And Song Dong, the one who is breathing, is working with water here. And I'm, next slide. You can see that, again, a similarity to Western art, but a very different purpose. He's showing that he's trying to print on water, and of course that doesn't work. Again, Chinese people felt, some of them felt this wasn't Chinese, and it was really frustrating. But others felt that he was getting at a deeper sensibility that's traditionally Chinese about water being this element and fluid, the whole concept of how it will flow and move is a living thing. So he's getting at that. Next slide. Next slide. So to conclude, the master, and that's Confucius, said, I'd love to just say nothing. But if you say nothing, said the adept king, how would we disciples hand down your teachings? What has heaven ever said, replied the master. The four seasons keep turning, the hundred things keep emerging. But what has heaven ever said? Next slide. So to me, that was very much Xu Bing, very much what a lot of Chinese artists are saying, that we should really talk more about what has heaven ever said. He's not saying it doesn't say anything. He's saying, what has it said? It's a language that we don't exactly speak, or it's not a word language that we can just read in that way. Nevertheless, next slide. My Chinese teacher was quite upset. He liked us to practice Chinese Confucianism. This is a much more traditional way where you do ceremonial, ritual Confucianism. That seemed to be part of what he wanted it to be. It never is that way in the West. Next slide. And just to finish, he felt that, I think he was very defensive about these issues. China seems pretty weak in understanding herself, making herself understandable to other people, other cultures. Next slide. They feel that a sense of shame that Chinese doesn't have the way to define itself as the West does. So I think he saw any inclusion of West into the art as a shame for China. I think this is the last slide. Yes. But a writer at the beginning of the 20th century looked at the 20th century and said, what is this? This isn't what we are. In a sense, you could see him as remonstrating against Confucius. He's saying all those Confucian values don't hold anymore. But really what he's doing is saying, this kind of rule, this kind of value structure isn't isn't right for us anymore. The needs of human beings have changed. And we have to get that rule right. Confucius wasn't making absolute values. He was teaching us relational values, how to think in terms of relationships, not only to one another, but to our past. We need to make those relationships relevant to the needs of each generation, adapting it and making it appropriate to our lives as they adapt it and make it appropriate to our lives as they unfold. So, in a sense, what some people see as the opposite of Confucianism is actually what others will say goes right to the root of Confucius values. Thank you very much. I appreciate your attention.
Wow. Having taught in China myself and seen some of these issues unfolding, I think that was really brilliant, very perceptive and insightful, especially your comparisons. So thank you very much.